We'd like to go ahead and get started with our session this morning. Welcome to Teaching Faith in Science, Higher Ed Course-Based Projects. I'm Ray Lewis. I am filling in for Dominic Halsmer this session. He was called away on an emergency. But my pleasure to welcome you to this session. And as a biologist, I'm looking forward to hearing the biology of these talks here. So we'd like to start off with Abby Scrotenboer, who will be talking about Along the Creek, where conservation science and sense of place meet.
Thank you. All right.
And here's the mic. Right
Should I
here.
Use the microphone? It's bigger than my normal venue here. So thank you for joining us. Today, and I imagine for many of us, we're spending a lot of time indoors, and you know when the heat is this high. We appreciate the air conditioning, and perhaps depending on where you work, you get a chance to get outdoors a little bit on my campus at Trinity Christian College, you know, get a little outdoor time from classroom building to classroom building and so on. But I like to invite my students to engage even on our own campus. We're blessed to have a natural area with a creek and woods around it. We have a trail that we affectionately call the Trin Trail. And so I invite my students to join me and also explore on their own this area and get to connect with God's creation, learn more about the creatures there and their interactions. As you might guess, I teach ecology and some of those related courses. So here are some framing questions for my talk today. Why seek this connection with God's creation and try to foster it in students? And then looking at some of the literature, thinking about sense of place and how we might connect that to our Christian view of creation care. And in doing so, thinking about how we can help foster and help develop earth keepers in ourselves and those around us, and how we might connect that to actually meeting conservation science goals as well. So as to why foster this connection with God's creation, for me, the root of it is that we are created to be in relationship with God, relationship with others, but also in relationship with all of creation. And of course, we know that there are broken relationships all around us, and that relationship with creation is one of those broken relationships. But a way that I often think of it, sort of framed from my context, is that we're called to be co-workers with Christ. And so working alongside Christ to try to mend those relationships on all the different fronts, but today thinking particularly about with the rest of creation. A quote that stood out to me as I've been thinking about this, not from a person of faith, but nevertheless I think makes a good point here. We cannot win this battle to save species and environments without forging an emotional bond between ourselves and nature as well. For we will not fight to save what we do not love. So they're connecting to that idea of bonding and relationship and connection and trying to build that up. So as we start to look at some of the literature on sense of place, let's talk about this term place. We use it a lot, but what do we mean specifically here? Well, part of it is location. So here I have the location of Trinity Christian College in Pilos Heights, one of the southwest suburbs, but it's much more than that, a meaningful location. And so for different people, place is going to mean different things depending on our experiences and context. So the different experiences in the lab and around campus for our college help shape the place that we experience, not just the space and the location. So there's been a lot of work on sense of place. One definition you can see here is subjective and emotional attachment people have to place. To get us a little more in depth, here's a quote from Anna Carr. Sense of place creates both a oneness or connection with the environment and with the people and local organizations who inhabit those places. It is not something which is acquired when you move into a new area or suburb. It has to be cultivated. Like culture, sense of place is changing and adaptive, not primordial and fixed. So just highlighting that this is something that develops. It depends on context and all kinds of things. So it's a complex thing. One paper looking at this idea of sense of place and touching on environmental implications kind of breaks it down further, thinking about place attachment, which can be dependence, like how place helps us achieve our goals, place identity, how we connect who we are to our place. Survey questions to evaluate this might sound something like, this place really reflects the kind of person I am, and the meanings that we associate with our place. Those things then influence our behavior, and of course things can circle back, so behavior then influences how we think of our place as well. The authors note that it's not always as simple as greater sense of place equals greater stewardship or pro-environmental action. So sometimes how we think of our place might actually make us more resistant to stewardship or certain kinds of change that could be environmentally beneficial. That comes up as we think about our relationship to the creatures around us. So here's thinking about the different animals in our places and spaces. Accounting for the ways in which animals are welcomed or alternatively labeled out of place is a telling component in the analysis of place creation. A couple interesting examples I found. There's actually a lot of good Australian literature on sense of place and place meanings. So they looked at homeowners and how they thought of the brush-tailed possum, a native species to Australia. And a lot of people saw it as like an invader on their homes, but actually a lot of people recognized that the possum was there before they were. And so really, they, in a sense, they were the invaders, and that made them more welcoming to the presence of the possum. We can see this with a different perspective with invasive species. Another study in Australia that looked at invasive albizia trees found that people with a stronger sense of place were more resistant to removing the invasive species because it had been there and they had associated that with their place. And here, raccoons in our area might be one of those complex relationships about how we think about them. So a lot of the literature has, you know, not been specifically from a faith perspective, but I think that can really enrich our understanding as we think about the creatures that we share space with, not just as part of, you know, the environment, but as part of God's creation. They are God's creatures. One author and thinker who's been resonating with me is Norman Wiersbe from Nature to Creation. I saw I can buy this here at the conference as well. And so part of his thinking is it depends on how we name things as well. So instead of saying nature, if we say creation, right, that brings a greater richness and depth to how we're thinking about it. And I just want to read a short quote here. Creation names the ongoing reality of human beings, animals, plants, land, and weather, all connected to each other and bound to God as their source, inspiration, and end. As such, the teaching of creation provides a moral and spiritual map that enables us to see the significance of things and then move faithfully through the world. When we confine creation to an originating event, we lose the sense of it as a dynamic place, so cherished that God enters into covenant relationship with it, so beautiful that God promises to renew it, and so valuable that God takes up residence within it. Creation is not a vast lump of valueless matter. It is God's love made visible, fragrant, tactile, audible, and delectable. So here, looking at a few additional studies thinking about sense of place. Here's a study from Sweden that was looking at different types of land use and the managers of those areas. And they assessed their sense of place, local ecological knowledge, comparing city parks, cemeteries, and allotment gardens. So allotment gardens are sort of similar to a community garden. And they found that in particular the allotment gardens, people had a higher sense of place, greater local ecological knowledge. And when they looked at some ecological variables, like in the graph here, bumblebee abundance as a measure of ecosystem health, that some of those measures were higher as too. So suggestive of how sense of place here, particularly coupled with the ecological knowledge, made a difference on the landscape. a couple of other studies just as examples. A study of rural communities in the United States looked at surveys evaluating sense of place, happiness with their sort of local community government, and different things. And one thing they found was that their community attachment related to more desire and willingness to take environmental actions. Another Australian study looking at volunteers in watershed activities, so monitoring water quality, planting trees, that type of thing. They surveyed people involved, asked sort of open-end question, why did you get involved with this? And the majority of participants mentioned some kind of connection, local attachment to that area that started this desire to be involved. Involved in education, I was definitely interested in some of the literature that looks at effects of environmental education. And so this was an interesting study from New York where they looked at youth programs in the summertime. They worked with existing programs. Some were environmentally focused and some were not. And then they did surveys on the participants in those so they could compare the two groups. And here are some of the items from the survey. So they had some that they related to what they call place attachment. So that was trying to get more at the emotional bond to that particular place, in this case, the Bronx. And then also questions that related to what they called ecological place meanings. And they determined these based on the programs themselves, what they thought were important environmental place meanings for the Bronx. And what they found was that in the environmentally focused programs, place meaning did increase. Their agreement with the statements about environmental place meaning were higher after the program, where they didn't change in the non-environmentally focused ones. So we see effect of that. However, place attachment did not increase even in the environmentally focused ones. And, you know, the authors don't have direct data on that part of it. They speculate it's likely just the time that it takes to develop those deeper meanings. But also, attachment is complex. So those statements were, you know, worded particularly for the Bronx. Some students may have developed more of attachment to a particular ecosystem as opposed to that ecosystem as it was found in their local area. So more complexity there. So kind of overview from some of the studies we've just briefly looked at, you know, probably affirms a lot of what us feel, a lot of us feel in general, right? That it's good to develop a sense of place that can make us better stewards, but just recognizing there's complexities there, like dealing with the invasive species, and there's not like a magic silver bullet quick answer to some of these things. So now to tell you a little bit about my own work, I have some projects relating to the creek that runs through our campus, looking at macroinvertebrates in the waterways, and also we've had students monitoring field cameras to see the wildlife around campus. So here's kind of my twofold goals of that, partly just to get data on, you know, what is on our campus that helps us to be good stewards, so that conservation science part, but also to help those students in their own development of sense of place and hopefully ultimately growing them into earth keepers. So a little bit on macroinvertebrates. What are they and what can they tell us? So in general, macroinvertebrate, right, it's an invertebrate, doesn't have a backbone, and it's big enough to see with the naked eye, although sometimes scopes help us identify them. So just a few examples of the kinds of things we find. Here's a damselfly nymph. You might recognize them more like this, but they live part of their lives in the water. Similar with the stone or mayfly nymph you could see here, and they come out of the water for a brief period of, you know, mating and reproduction. A couple types of species we see commonly that live their life in the water, aquatic sow bugs and planaria, these little flatworms that are really cool to watch. Oh, and what can they tell us? The types of species we find give us an indication of the water quality, which I'll tell you more about in a moment. So here, a few pictures of sampling the creeks. Mostly it's been done in warmer weather, but I had one spring class where we were sampling in the snow. So that was Navajo Creek. Tinley Creek is a nearby creek, not on campus, but close by. And so taking a dip net, sampling for the species there, taking those back to the lab to identify them. So here's what we've been using to do an assessment of the water quality. It's calculating a pollution tolerance index. This comes from Hoover River Watch. And so you can see here that on the left you have intolerant species. So that means they do not tolerate pollution well. They're more sensitive. So if you see those, that's an indicator of better water quality. And then going down to the right, very tolerant. So as far as calculating the index, you get a greater weighting factor, sort of like more bang for your species if you find species in those intolerant groups. And that's how you calculate the pollution tolerance index. So that's what we've been using to get a rating on our waterways. Just a quick look at some of our results. You can see two different locations along the Navajo Creek that's on our campus, and then the creek we compared to that was nearby. Navajo Creek mostly in the good range, but you can see some fluctuations. Tinley Creek overall lower water quality. If I show you a more complete set for one of the Navajo Creek sites that I've been sampling for a longer period of time with one of my classes, that trend seems to hold mostly in the good range, but with some fluctuations as well. A little bit on the field cameras here. You can see across the creek there's a little field camera attached to the tree. So we can see what kind of animals are using the creek in our local habitat. Also captures students who are out to collect the photos. And I always like to do a little audience participation. So here is your field camera species quiz. So especially if you're from the Midwest, these should be some familiar species. So what do we have here? Mallards. Great blue heron.
Wood duck.
Sounds a little tricky. I heard it. Yeah, black-crowned night heron. So a number of birds using the creek. And then here on the right, you probably all know that's a raccoon. But for scale, who's that creature on the left? A muskrat, yes. So a lot of creatures using this habitat right in our backyard, our campus. Now with the field cameras, sometimes you get this whole group of male wood ducks or a group of raccoons. Of course, sometimes you get nothing at all, right? The camera gets triggered. So you get a lot of these that you have to look through too. A few quick results from that study. Well, it's been sort of sporadic on and off with different classes, but overall since we put the field cameras out, we've documented 29 native species that we share a campus with. We're a focus study for one of my classes where we had them all the cameras aimed at the creek. Found 17 different species that semester. Here you can see the frequency they were seen in the photos. Obviously, frequency there relates also to their activity, not just the number of individuals. And, we're not surprised to see raccoons is pretty high up there in our suburban environment, but also good to see those, wood ducks and great blue herons that we might not see in person so often, but we know they're out there from our field cameras. Another study using the field cameras is just looking at coyote activity on campus. And so I had a student really passionate about this topic, and he found that the coyotes really are active, can be all kinds of times of day, so it's not just at night or something like that. So I thought this was a nice example of how our data can help us think about interacting with the environment. We know the coyotes are really active and present on campus, so how can we educate people and just inform people that, we share our campus space with these coyotes, and recognizing more generally our campus as important habitat. Other takeaways, like from the stream data, rates we see overall that our Navajo Creek looks fairly healthy, could be better, but it provides a nice baseline to see, if things decrease in future, what is it that we can identify that might be a problem and improve it. And of course, all the while, getting students out there in the creek, looking at photos, those types of things to engage them. One thing I'm exploring is using Zooniverse, which is like a citizen science hub website where you can start your own project, upload photos. So this is not yet live, but it's something I've started to work on. And interest in thinking about, here they're not going outside to see these things, but if we see the pictures of the creatures sharing our campus, how does that help us develop sense of place? maybe that's helpful as an introduction for STEM students. So here are some of my own questions that maybe you can help me think about as we have a little time for questions and thoughts in a moment. How to encourage students in engaging with creation in more hands-on ways without overwhelming them. I sometimes find, particularly in my classes for non-majors, that they're like, whoa, this is like too much. So how do we find that balance, but really getting them out there as well? And how to better evaluate whether my students are developing a deeper sense of place, how that might connect to their environmental actions. I don't know that I want to go the route of, you know, actually doing a formal study of that, but how could I just understand that better and see where I can make improvements? And of course, overall, thinking about this bigger picture about how we can embrace and build up healthy relationships around us, in particular those with creation. So with that, I have some people and places to thank, particularly many of the students who worked on these projects. Thank you for listening, and now I'll be happy to take any questions or be interested to hear your thoughts. We do get a lot of those.
But it was fascinating. The other thing is, did you collect chemical data? Chemical data?
For the recording, could you go ahead and answer on there? Yeah, just in fact, you can repeat the question.
So the question was about chemical data, and so not as extensively as the macrovertebrate data, but when we have tested for nitrogen and phosphorus, generally pretty low, in the sort of safe range. But yes, I do think the erosion probably is one of the major problems. Catherine doing a lot of invasive species removal, and they're like, what, this is stewardship taking out these plants? So you really got to kind of prep them for that. A lot of them, I think, don't have that deep sense of place, so it's not so much a resistance to like, oh, well, this is part of the place, but just like, oh, I didn't know stewardship could be this kind of thing. But that would be interesting to explore more.
Regarding the relationship aspect you just on the last slide there, to what extent does the social interaction of the students encourage their sense of place? We talk mostly with the other references about how engaging with nature, creation develops that, but I think the social aspect would be very important. What do you know about that?
Right, yeah, definitely an important part of sense of place. You know, there's the U.S. sort of Midwest study, looked generally at community attachment. So that wasn't necessarily environmental attachment, but just community attachment was associated with greater environmental, wanting to take greater environmental action. You know, just anecdotally, when you have a student in a class who's like really engaged, right, they pull others in. So I definitely think that's an important part, but haven't explored that as specifically.
How quickly do you see the invertebrates change in response to something that's going on?
That's a good question. You know, overall has been fairly consistent, although you saw kind of a big spike for one data point. I imagine it depends a lot on the, severity and what type of disturbance might do the effect. So yeah, I'm not sure exactly.
So I have kind of a practical question. I like the idea, you come out of the Bay Area and we talk about are animals welcomed, mm-hmm. or are they said to be on the place? So I grow stuff, peaches, pears, wine grapes, raspberries, all kinds of stuff. And on the one hand, as a person who has a strong application as a gardener and farmer, I'm intimately aware of the effect of what the French call terroir, right? The sense of when you grow wine grapes, the place makes all the difference in the world as to what you grow. Two of the same varietals can make a different kind of a wine depending upon the entire characteristic of the place you live in, not just the location, as you put it. So on the one hand, I have a sense of that. On the other hand, when you're a farmer, you don't romanticize nature. And people really tend to forget this. There are people who don't think about nature, they don't know where the food comes from. And then there are people who romanticize it, think that Bambi is always wonderful. And the raccoons aren't trash cans, but they're just adorable. It's a kind of art. But when you lost every blueberry to them, you kind of have a different sense. I will tell you this too. Do you have any practical measures for people like me who grow things about how to make animals be welcome? And yet not pests, but really figure out how to live with them in a way that's more and more harmonious. And it's because we gain technology, we ought to be able to use our technology to learn how to do these kind of things.
Right. Yeah, and I think, it starts with, it sounds like, kind of where you're at, awareness, right, that there's always, like, costs and benefits to, what we need to do to grow our food or whatever it is that we're trying to do. So awareness and trying to look for, what can, help me protect my crop, but also be sensitive to the ecosystem. So I don't have any specific answers for you, but I think just having that awareness is definitely the first step.